At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. In which the theme of the broadcast is, it has already started, Trump, day three, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. Friday, November the 11th, the 11th day of the 11th month. Happy Veterans Day, everybody. Good to have you along. So what should we talk about, huh? Anything happened this week? I mean, anything with potentially global economic implications? Lee Gallagher is here. She is at Fortune Magazine. Cardiff Garcia is at the blog FT Alphaville. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai. Given how sleepy it's been, I'm surprised we're even having this segment.
we're trying to be a little.
What are we going
to
talk about?
I don't even know. All right. So listen, Cardiff. Let me start with you. We had a whole bunch of conversations back at the depth of the financial crisis about America's global reputation in the economic sense. Do you think the events of Tuesday night are going to bear on that?
It's a risk, and here's why. Because throughout Donald Trump's campaign, he did at times denigrate some of the very institutions that he is now going to be leading. So at one point, for example, he suggested that he might be open to renegotiating the debt of the United States, mm-hmm. which cast doubt on it. He said that he might enact tariffs so high that they'd almost certainly go against the rules of the World Trade Organization, of which the U.S. is a member and a participating member. He said that he might rip up existing trade agreements. And so what we're seeing now is a continuation of political risk migrating from the developing world, where we always thought it was most prominent, to the developed world, something that started, I think, with the financial crisis. It continued with the euro crisis. And now it's a risk in the Trump presidency, even if there's a good chance that he's going to have to walk some of that back because the realities of governing are very different from the realities of campaigning.
Yeah, we'll get to the walk back in a second. But Lee, let's think for a second about stuff like the TPP, which has been officially declared dead on Capitol Hill this week, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There is now room economically for others to step in, China, for instance, in the Asia-Pacific region.
There is. And I think the trade policy, I mean, trade was one of the few things he got specific on. And I think that is where I think that's one of the riskier parts of his whole,
the one thing he suggested
that was specific. But I think our reputation was damaged just during the campaign, just from the, from all these things that were coming out.
Yeah.
And, our global economic reputation, it's funny. I mean, it took a hit, I think, back in the debt ceiling discussion.
Oh, yeah. Well, every time that comes up, right?
It's always the politics. It's never the actual economy. It's the politics that get us in trouble in reputational terms, I think. So,
Cardiff, talk to me for a second about some of the actual economics that are going to start happening. We're going to talk later in the broadcast about the president-elect's infrastructure plan, $1 trillion plus or minus. Talk to me about all that money coming into an economy that is not growing as much as anybody wants it to.
Well, I think
I hear you chuckling right there.
No, we're going to enter a really fascinating period of horse trading, and it's going to be between Trump and his fellow Republicans rather than with the Democrats, because Republicans now hold both houses of Congress and, of course, the presidency. And, a lot of what Trump has proposed goes against traditional conservative principles. So he might be trading a big infrastructure package for the kinds of tax cuts that the Republicans are hoping for. That, in the near term can, in fact, spur quite a bit of growth. It might have complicated or even corrosive long-term effects, but that's really hard to discern right now. So what ends up coming out of these negotiations is going to be really intriguing to watch.
Lee, do you take solace in some of his more extreme promises being tempered in just the reality of politicking and governing?
Not really. I mean, everybody says, oh, he was so magnanimous in his remarks, but that alone is eccentric and unpredictable. I mean, he's already going against everything he said. And so I think all this stuff we're talking about, a lot of it may play out as the way we think it might, but we just have we have no idea what is actually going to happen, what he's actually going to do.
Yeah, Kai, if I can jump in here real quickly on Lee, to what Lee said, Trump's entire campaign was a kind of Rorschach test where he was hoping that people would essentially project onto him what they wanted to believe. As a campaigning tactic, it turns out to have been effective because he won, but it makes it so hard to predict in advance what's actually going to happen once he's in office.
Cardiff Garcia is at the blog FT Alphaville. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. Lots to talk about in the next 4 years. Thanks very much, both of you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, traders did calm down a little bit, the Trumpian exuberance having run its course. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know, what's funny is all these conversations about what the president-elect is going to do kind of overlap on each other. The president-elect is wasting no time getting going with some of his campaign promises, as Cardiff and Lee and I were just talking about. Most prominently among them, renegotiating or withdrawing entirely from NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Mr. Trump, as Lee said, made no secret during the campaign of his disdain for it. Interestingly enough, though, just this week, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he is, quote, more than happy to talk, end of quote, about NAFTA. Mexico does seem less thrilled, but there is a gears of government question to be asked here, and this is it. How exactly would renegotiating NAFTA work? Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Getting out of NAFTA, a president can do that pretty easily.
NAFTA provides for withdrawal very clearly in Article 2205.
Andy Scheuer is a partner at the law firm Sidley Austin in Washington.
You give 6 months' notice, and 6 months later, the withdrawal is effective, and then the agreement would remain in force for the other parties.
But, I mean, I don't think that that's really what he wants to do. It sounds like what he would like to do is renegotiate it.
Rachel Brewster teaches international trade law at Duke. She says trade deals, including NAFTA, get informally renegotiated all the time. But if Trump wants to dramatically reshape it,
the parties would just get together, they'd write a new agreement, they'd make that agreement preempt the old agreement, and then that agreement would have to pass Congress.
That is, if the other parties are willing. If Trump wants to slap a 35% tariff on Mexican imports, as he's threatened, Brewster says Mexico is not likely to agree to that. Jeffrey Schott with the Peterson Institute for International Economics says a unilateral move by Trump could violate other trade rules.
Many of the actions that were discussed during the election campaign probably would run afoul of WTO obligations.
All three countries are members of the World Trade Organization. Schott says if the U.S. were found in violation by the WTO of discriminating against its trading partners, they could retaliate with tariffs of their own. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If you read the Constitution, it says the Trump administration won't start until noon on January 20th. The markets, however, say we are already on its third day. Trump plus three, T plus three in the vernacular. Stocks we've talked about already a little bit. How about commodities, though? Copper and iron ore are both up by a lot, in large part because of the president-elect's promises to spend a boatload of money on infrastructure. $1 trillion, as I mentioned earlier, on bridges and roads and airports. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the story.
President-elect Trump's plan calls for tax relief for private businesses to invest in projects. And in doing so, the plan says it wouldn't increase national debt. Heidi Kribo-Redeker is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She says private investment can be good, but this plan is all private investment.
If you look at this as a taxpayer, do you pay your taxes to fund infrastructure investment that can then rely on cheap government borrowing to invest in those projects?
Or do you rely on private investors who will borrow more expensive money and then charge you a toll to use the bridges and roads that they built? Lindsay Piegza is chief economist at Stifel Fixed Income. She says a lot of analysts and investors have been begging for this kind of investment and relaxed regulation for years.
And so there is this euphoric optimism that's being priced in. But does it reflect the reality? Does it reflect an undermining change in the fundamentals of the economy? Not yet.
But the commodities markets aren't listening. Copper hit a 17-month high. That's one reason Phil Flynn, senior market analyst at Price Futures Group, is optimistic.
You know, they used to call copper Dr. Copper. If Dr. Copper's doing well, it's a good sign for the economy and everybody else is going to catch up. Well, Dr. Copper has had its best run in 30 years, so I hope that bodes well for our economic future.
Though until the details of the Trump infrastructure investment plan get fleshed out, we're likely to see commodities prices come back to earth. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
There are a couple of sectors that have been largely bypassed by the Trump rally this week. Hospital stocks, for one, with the prospect of Obamacare being unwound. Also, tech. Most of the biggies lost ground in part because of the things Mr. Trump has said about some of the tech sector's biggest names, Apple CEO Tim Cook and Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, among them. But also in part because of what Donald Rumsfeld would call unknown unknowns, the incoming administration's tech policies. We got our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood on the phone to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
What do we know about the Trump administration's technology policies?
We know next to nothing. In fact, the plan for the first 100 days that is up on the Trump campaign website says nothing about technology. I think there's one line about technical education in a section about schools.
Right.
And as for the rest of it, it is it's anybody's guess.
All right, so let's run through a couple here that there's going to have to be some kind of meeting of the minds on between the White House and Silicon Valley. Number one would probably be security, right? I mean, as you said, he beat up on Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, over the San Bernardino iPhone. That whole thing is not going away.
No, it's absolutely not. And of course, you know, law enforcement and national security officials, even within the existing government, are split on this question. And so most analysts believe that the Trump administration is likely to weaken encryption and also make some personnel changes that could affect privacy. For example, he is very likely to very quickly replace the current head of the FCC, which, of course, sets telecom and broadband policy. And he has spoken disfavorably of the FCC's open internet initiative or basically net neutrality regulations.
Right.
Now, if those are rolled back, that could impact privacy protections on existing broadband and telecom providers. So look for basically attacks on encryption and potentially on consumer privacy.
We talked a little bit on the program yesterday about immigration and agriculture policy and the guest worker program there. H-1B visas, Donald Trump has said, he calls them, cheap labor, right? And he wants an absolute requirement on American workers first.
That's exactly it. Silicon Valley is extremely concerned about the H-1B visa program. And Donald Trump has said, as you pointed out on the campaign trail, that it has been an excuse for people in the Valley to hire outside workers and not American workers. But he has not and is very unlikely to implement any sort of corresponding funding for technical education in this country, STEM education. He maintains that we graduate more than enough people in fields of technology that should be able to fill those jobs.
So here comes a more abstract question, I guess, right? Silicon Valley and high tech in this country are all about trying stuff and seeing what happens and innovating the heck out of things. Where does that go when we literally don't know what the administration's policies are going to be toward innovation, toward technology, toward funding and all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could argue that it's an opportunity to innovate around that uncertainty or to try to set an agenda to get in his ear quickly. And convince him, for one thing, that these issues are important. I think that what Silicon Valley is really worried about is that this has been a really vibrant sector of our economy and that technology touches every single part of every other business. It is integral to the conversations about globalization, to conversations about job growth, because so many of the jobs that the Trump administration is talking about trying to create or bring home are jobs that have been or will very soon be automated. So I think that it's an opportunity for Silicon Valley, if it can stop the freak out, to say, how can we help shape this agenda in a positive way? Because that's what we do.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Coming up,
the president is not going to be able to control most of what it does.
It being the whole executive branch of the government of the United States. POTUS as manager, straight ahead. But first, yeah, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Like it's really a choice, right? The Dow Industrials is up 39 points, 0.2%, 18,847. The NASDAQ up 28 points, 0.5%, 5,237. It could be a choice, I suppose. S&P 500 off 3 points, 0.1%, 2,164. About that Trumpian exuberance, the Dow up 5.4%, the NASDAQ up 3.8%, the S&P 500 also up 3.8%. Energy companies flagged today as crude oil prices fell. ExxonMobil down 1.6%. Chevron dipped about 1% today. Accessories retailer Michael Kors discounted 4% after cutting its revenue and profits forecast for next year. It cited lower mall traffic. Nordstrom shot up 4.8% today, better than expected earnings late yesterday after the bell. Bond markets closed today in observance of Veterans Day. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We were talking this morning in our editorial meeting about how to cover the incoming administration. And somebody said that there's a whole series to be done about how you dismantle existing government policies and programs, because that's what Donald Trump has promised to do. He's going to start with President Obama's executive orders, things a president gets to decide with not much more than the stroke of a pen. It is simple, but not necessarily easy, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
It'll be easy for Trump to undo President Obama's executive orders. It's as simple as
issuing a new executive order.
John Hudak of the Brookings Institution.
Issuing a new memorandum, issuing a directive to cabinet agencies, but it can be done quite quickly.
But of course, nothing in Washington is really that simple. For one thing, the new president will have to deal with federal workers who may not be too enthusiastic about undoing things they've spent the last 8 years working on. Mark Roselle at George Mason University says bureaucrats have ways of dealing with executive orders they don't like.
Kill it by inaction or delay. Of course, that has been a matter of frustration for presidential administrations.
Here's another complication. Roselle says Trump will have to be careful about issuing executive orders that benefit some people, like protections for undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, or insurance for people with pre-existing conditions. Timothy Jost is an emeritus professor at Washington and Lee University. He says businesses could also lose out if patients suddenly become uninsured because of an executive order.
And we're talking about hospitals ending up holding the bag for uncompensated care if their patients lose health insurance or Medicaid coverage.
So sure, executive orders are easy. Making them stick without upsetting voters and powerful interests in Washington, that's the tricky part. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
You could say Donald Trump delivered quite the plot twist this week. You could also say it's not a storyline that most of Hollywood is eager to embrace. Not in real life, anyway. But what about on screen? Marketplace's Rima Kreis looks at how the entertainment industry might respond to Tuesday's election.
Here's how the creators of South Park spent election night, frantically writing Hillary Clinton out of their Wednesday episode and writing Trump in.
America's going to be great again. Aren't you excited, gang?
No, I'm not excited!
Media critic Brian Lowry says more TV shows are likely to ramp up their political jokes and references. And he says several shows were already in development before the election that have storylines about Hispanics and immigration.
So it will be interesting to see whether those projects get put on the front burner or the back one.
Steve Ross, a history professor at USC, says the entertainment industry is divided into two camps. You've got the creative people.
A lot of them will be submitting projects that are more likely to be critical of where we are right now.
Then Ross says there's corporate Hollywood.
They're not going to greenlight things that are going to get the Trump administration up in arms.
And he says they're not going to take risks that may not pay off at the box office. TV writer and producer Javier Grillo Markswatch says Trump's election is more likely to drive change, like increasing diversity, behind the scenes.
Because the economics of activism in front of the camera are much more limited.
One studio managed to get out ahead of the election. In 2014, the Lego movie featured a villain named President Business.
Meet President Business.
Hi, I'm President Business, president of the Octan Corporation and the world. Let's take extra care.
And there's a sequel in the works. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
When Donald Trump takes office, he's going to take on the management of the biggest, most powerful employer in the country. More workers than Walmart, McDonald's, and Target combined. It is, of course, the executive branch of the American government. Mr. Trump will have a spectacular opportunity to put new policies into place, but he also faces the challenge of managing this unwieldy and not necessarily cooperative workforce, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains.
Today's federal government would probably be unrecognizable to the founding fathers.
The founders did not anticipate an executive branch as large and powerful as the one that we have today.
Eric Posner is professor of law at University of Chicago. He says it was FDR who paved the way.
Before the New Deal, the general understanding was that regulation would mostly take place through the states. During the Great Depression, FDR created a new type of federal bureaucracy that was much more powerful.
And then as the economy and life generally became more complicated, the government kept up. We got the EPA under Nixon, FEMA under Carter.
Congress created these regulatory agencies and then asked those people to make policy so that Congress itself wouldn't have to.
And now, from the FBI to Border Patrol to Department of Energy, we have 4.2 million executive branch employees, plus untold numbers of contractors. How does one person manage all that?
So the answer is they don't, but they try.
David Lewis is professor of political science at Vanderbilt University. First things first, the president has to get the right people to manage for him.
There's, 3,000 to 4,000 appointed positions, and their success in selecting people for these positions will determine how successful they are at controlling what those agencies do.
Finding the right people and finding people with management experience is hard.
President Kennedy said, "I thought I knew a bunch of people, but it turned out I just knew a bunch of politicians."
Appointees may be loyal, or they may have their own agendas. And presidents can't appoint absolutely anyone they want.
They also have to be beholden to other considerations, whether it's the preferences of the Senate or different factions within their party or key groups that they made pledges to during the campaign.
Now, managing a bureaucracy by finding other people to manage a bureaucracy is one thing. But how to manage a bureaucracy well? That's different.
We were confronted with the question that you've just asked.
Morley Winograd was a senior policy advisor to Al Gore and director of the National Partnership for Reinventing Government. This was a Bill Clinton-era government reform program.
There's four P's, if you will, that the president worries about: politics, public relations, policy, and performance. And performance for every president always ranks last.
There isn't, for example, a regular bureaucracy performance briefing like there is for national security or economics.
It's just not at the top of the agenda because it appears to have the least impact on the question that most politicians are most interested in, which is, how do I get reelected?
So, Winograd says, the key to good management of the bureaucracy starts with just paying attention to it.
To make sure that it's a priority on their list of things to do. Not on the legislative side of things, but in the face time, the precious resource of a daily calendar.
Put someone in charge of performance, he says. Someone with direct access to the president. For Bill Clinton, that was Al Gore. Presidents Bush and Obama had something called the President's Management Council, which advises the president on performance. But challenges aside, as unruly as the executive branch can be, the fact that it is so sprawling and difficult to get a grip on is actually the source of one of the president's powers. Eric Posner.
The executive branch is so gigantic that the president is not going to be able to control most of what it does. It's just going to continue doing what it's done in the past.
And in fact, some bureaucracies may actively resist a president's efforts. People can resign, obstruct, whistleblow.
But he can pick a few things that he cares about a lot.
And focus on them. Use his discretion as to what to enforce and what not to enforce. Emphasize border control or health and human services, the IRS or the EPA. In some ways, which part of the bureaucracy a president grabs hold of can define his legacy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Facebook's algorithm got a little bit confused. Apparently, friends of people who had worked on the Clinton campaign are sending condolence messages over Facebook, which the internal Facebook gears for a while today interpreted to mean that that person getting the notes had died. A message reading, "We hope people who love Joe, for instance, will find comfort in the things others share to remember and celebrate his life." That appeared at the top of the very much alive person's page. Facebook did fix it after just a couple hours. All right. On a Friday, at the end of a week in which history was quite literally made, we got to go. The Dow up 39 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 28 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 off 3 points. That is a 0.1%. Quick note here to let you know there is a new episode of our podcast, Politics Inside Out, that dropped today. Me and today our Washington Bureau Chief Andrea Seabrook talking about the economic state of play on Trump plus three. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.